Right, brethren, we're continuing with our study of the book of Isaiah, or Isaiah, if you prefer. This will be, I think, study number 4, and we won't do, I think, any real recap today, otherwise it'll take us several years to get to the end of the book of Isaiah, so we'll pick up pretty much where we were last week, and if you open your Bibles initially at least to Isaiah 13, and we'll probably leave it promptly and go to Revelation, but you may as well open it then, stick your $50 bill in to mark the spot. Isaiah 13 and Isaiah 14, although we have two chapters in our Bible, it's really just one prophecy. And verse 1 tells us the burden, or the heavy, weighty prophecy against Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw. So some sort of vision that Isaiah saw against Babylon. Now, at the time that Isaiah was living, Babylon wasn't actually the most powerful nation. The most powerful nation was the nation of Assyria. And we probably perceive Assyria today to be modern-day Germany. And so when we see prophecies of Assyria, we tend to apply those, as far as we can at least, to Germany of today, or perhaps a German-led group of nations. Babylon at this stage, when Isaiah wrote, had still not come to be the dominant power. That was some decades, perhaps the best part of 60, 70 years in the future. And here's Isaiah talking about Babylon's downfall. Well, bearing in mind that Isaiah is writing roughly 700 BC, give or take, and Babylon didn't fall, at least the city didn't fall, until 539 BC. That's about 160 odd years future. So Isaiah was indeed prophesying of something that was a long, long way off in the future. But also, we believe, he's prophesying of something a long, long way after even that. And he's prophesying of events to take place, I guess we all hope, in our lifetime, the fall of Babylon today. And I guess the question we were covering last week is, well, where is Babylon today? If it's prophecy, and it refers a few places to the day of the Lord, if that's referring to our time, if that's referring to the intervention by God in the affairs of this earth in the day of the Lord, where or what is Babylon? Is there a Babylon today? So if you keep your place there and just for a moment turn back to Revelation 17, or turn forward to it if you prefer, Revelation 17, and we'll just read 3 or 4 of the verses that we read last week, because the answer is, prophetically, there is a Babylon on the earth today, and is very powerful, and pretty much most of the world, to some extent, is influenced even today by Babylon of old. Look at Revelation 17, and picking up in verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, John, saying to me, "Come, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot, this great whore, who sits on many waters." And many waters are many nations and tongues and peoples, a huge group of people on the earth, with whom, verse 2, the kings of the earth, or presidents and prime ministers and governors and rulers, have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. That's talking of the occupants of planet Earth. Their minds have been befuddled by the teachings of this great whore, this great harlot. And looking at verse 5, and on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So here, looking into the future, this angel refers to a mystery, Babylon the Great, who has influenced and made drunk and deceived and befuddled the peoples of the earth, and has committed fornication with the kings, presidents, prime ministers of the earth. So, yeah, Babylon the Great, it exists. Look at verse 14. These, talking of the horns, will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb, Jesus Christ, will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him at his return are called, chosen, and faithful. Well, that's not happened yet. So the destruction of mystery Babylon the Great is yet future, and you can't destroy something that doesn't exist. So Babylon the Great, look around you. It still influences this earth. Christmas, Easter, but also banking, finance, governments. Much of this earth shows the, if you like, the footprint, the handprint of ancient Babylon. Look at Revelation 18 and verse 2. And here we get the yet future destruction. And don't forget, Isaiah was prophesying of the eventual complete destruction of Babylon. As is typical with many prophecies, there was a near fulfillment to apply more or less in Isaiah's day, plus 160 odd years, and a far fulfillment yet to come. Revelation 18:2, and he, this angel, cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. That might imply, you know, it's fallen twice. Once, you know, centuries ago, and once at this yet future time, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Everybody, really. Ordinary people, if you want to use that expression. Merchants, military men, religious men, everybody been affected to some extent. And verse 4 says, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. And at the end of the ages, Babylon will be destroyed. God will pour out multiple plagues on her to destroy, and he says, get out. Don't be there, don't stay there. And in a sense, that may be in a sense also, you know, to do with your mind. You know, don't have the mind. Scripture says elsewhere, don't be conformed to this world. That's what it says in Romans 2. Do not be conformed to this world. Romans 12, I should say, verse 2. Romans 12, verse 2 says, don't be conformed to this world, this society, but be renewed, be transformed. Because this world operates according to the principles of Babylon. And you know, I don't want to be a people who have the values and the philosophy and the outlook of Babylon. Get out. Don't be part of it. You may be in the world, but don't be of the world. We may live in Babylon the Great, but don't be of it. So he says, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, lest you receive of her plagues, for her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. He's going to do something. Verse 8, therefore her plagues will come in one day, death, mourning, and famine, and she'll be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. And if that is to be taken literally, and that's what my colored verse says, because I've colored it in with one day being highlighted, if that is what happens, you're talking of her being attacked, because God generally uses one nation to attack and correct another nation, and Babylon is going to be attacked, it would seem, by the nations of Russia and the Chinese Asiatic nations. That's hinted at in a few places. And one day, so that implies potentially that could be nuclear weapons being released, so as to destroy and bring down Babylon the Great in virtually no time. Look at verse 21 finally. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found any more. Violently. Not a gradual decline and just eventually petering out. This is a violent, destructive end to Babylon the Great, and it exists today, and will get its punishment. So back to Isaiah chapter 13, And this is what Isaiah is prophesying of the destruction of Babylon of his day, albeit over a century yet ahead of him, and in our day today. So let's read chapter 13, let's start at verse 4. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like that of many people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. You know, God is bringing some pretty violent, powerful nations against Babylon then, and Babylon today. Huge in our day. The Lord of hosts musters the army for battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the eternal, and his weapons of indignation to destroy the whole land of Babylon. Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. So here is Isaiah prophesying near and far, and certainly in his day, you know, Babylon would be destroyed by the Medes and Persians. Daniel refers to some of that in his prophecies. But in our day today, our belief has always been the Medes can be found today in Russia and areas like that, and over towards the Asiatic nations. And there's another reason for thinking that. So here it talks about these armies have been brought together to destroy Babylon. And if we think of it in our day today, a very large number of people, I think we'll see that in a moment, in Revelation again, are going to head off to destroy Babylon today, whose headquarters will be somewhere in Europe. We're going to find, I think, in the future, a strong military leader working with a strong religious leader, and the final resurrection of what we call the Holy Roman Empire, and they will dominate certainly Europe and much of the globe, and they will take on much of the world, and there will be a massive counterattack, which appears to be what's being referred to here, that God's going to sort them out, going to bring these armies from afar to destroy Babylon. Drop down to verse 8, and they will be afraid. Pangs and sorrows will take hold of them. They will be in pain as a woman in childbirth. They will be amazed at one another. Their faces will be like flames. There's fear and terror. Take them when they know who's coming at them. Behold, the day of the Lord comes cruel, with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, land of Babylon, basically Western Europe. In our day today, obviously, much more literal back in Isaiah's day. And again it says the day of the Lord, which is why you can see that Isaiah is weaving into his story here events of his day-ish, plus the day of the Lord is clearly moving to, well, we hope our day. We don't quite know when that will be, whether it'll be kicking off next year or the year after, or maybe quite a few years away. I think most of us have always hoped to be around to see those events, hopefully from a safe vantage point, not right in the middle of them. But the day of the Lord certainly is yet future, and there's going to be a massive amount of destruction heading towards Western Europe and the modern day leader and leaders of Babylon. It says he will destroy its sinners from it, for the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. Well, there are heavenly signs, and the book of Revelation refers to those. It says, I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible, of the tyrants. I will make a mortal more rare than fine gold, a man more than the golden wedge of Ophir. So there'll be so many people killed that human beings in Babylon, it appears to be, I think, all focused on the destruction of Babylon. And so it does look like there'll be a huge amount of destruction, and you know, a large number of men will disappear dead. And verse 13, therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of his fierce anger. So we're talking here about a yet future time. The earth apparently will be knocked out of its orbit, in part, And look, we won't turn there. There are various scriptures that talk about the earth's temperature rocketing. So there's burning and blazing and so on. Earthquakes, volcanoes. Very destructive time ahead of us. And I guess all of us have a hope that we might be taken to a place of some safety from the worst of these events. But for the Babylonians or Western Europe, those who heeded the voices of the leaders of Babylon, the future religious leader and the future leader of the beast, they're going to suffer because they've not put their trust in God. And in a sense, when we read these things, as Isaiah would do, you could think, well, there's some encouragement here because the nations who caused such trouble to Israel will get, their comeuppance. They will get dealt with. They won't escape. And clearly God will have to use these nations to judge his people. Having done that, they're not allowed to go scot-free. Therefore it says, I will shake the heavens and the earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. It shall be as the hunted gazelle and as a sheep that no man takes up. Every man will turn to his own people. Everyone will flee to his own land. Everyone who is found will be thrust through. Everyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their children also be dashed to pieces before their eyes, their houses plundered, their wives ravished. Not a pleasant time to be in Babylon. And hopefully, if there's enough warning beforehand, perhaps some of these people of Babylon or the Holy Roman Empire will, make their peace with God and escape these things. But if they don't, this is what's going to happen. Verse 17, behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. So up to now we didn't know who's going to actually be the one that God will bring against Babylon then and now, but now it's named the Medes. The Medes took Babylon in 539 BC. In our day today, although these things aren't always, it's not always possible to be fully 100% confident of identifying today's descendants of these ancient tribes and peoples, the view's always been this is probably the Russians, the Soviets, Asiatic peoples, and in our day today, well, hopefully in our day fairly soon, these are the peoples who'll be sent against Western Europe, against the Holy Roman Empire. It says, they will not regard silver, and as for gold, they will not delight in it. They're not going to be distracted by offers of wealth and so on. Not going to be sidetracked. They're going to be pretty focused on what they're going to do. Also, their bows will dash the young men to pieces. They will have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eye will not spare children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, as at least she saw herself, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Destroyed. If we hold the place there for a moment and turn to Revelation 9 and verse 13, we can see how this apparently acts out in the future. Revelation 9 and beginning in verse 13. And of course, prophecy is not that easy to understand in advance. It's a lot easier after it happens to look back and say, oh, I guess that was how that particular portion there worked out. But here in Revelation 9, we're making our way through the various trumpets. You'll recollect there were seven seals. And the seventh seal, when you open it, there are seven trumpets. And the seventh trumpet, when you blow that, there are seven vials or plagues. But here we're at the sixth trumpet, the fifth trumpet, Revelation 9 verse 1, is that leads us into a comment about Assyria, modern day Germany, and all the woes and troubles it caused. When we get to verse 13, according to my inspired marginal note here, it says a Russian counterattack. So Western Europe has tried to attack the East. It has not been entirely successful. And verse 13 appears to be the counterattack against modern-day Babylon, against the Holy Roman Empire. This at least has always been our sort of view. Time, I guess, will say just how accurate we are. But beginning verse 13, then the sixth angel sounded. This is the sixth trumpet, yet future. And I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates, which is in the Middle East. So the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year, a very specific moment in time, were released to kill a third of mankind. Now, that possibly is a third of the whole world, but the context suggests it's one third of the empire they're attacking, which would mean, in other words, if they're attacking the Holy Roman Empire, if that's the counterattack, then it's one third of Europe they were going to be killed. Verse 16, now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million, and I heard the number of them, well, you couldn't look and count them, I suppose. Count all the horses and divide by four, and that's the number of them. Well, you heard the number. Somebody said, oh, John, there's 200 million in that army, and that's a big army. And I guess that implies that, you know, this scripture could not have been fulfilled, you know, in 500 AD or 1000 AD or 1500 AD. There weren't enough people on the earth in those days to make an army up that size. Today you could manage that. But 200 million is a pretty big army. That's like huge. And that would take up, well, if you include Chinese, you could get there. So the idea of the Medes or the Russians, who are quite, of course, quite a military nation, certainly have been. And if you add in the Chinese and other Soviet nations, then you're looking at potentially, well, not potentially, it says 200 million. Big army. Verse 17, thus I saw the horses in the vision. Those who sat on them had breastplates of fiery red, hyacinth blue, sulfur yellow. The heads of the horses were like the heads of lions. Out of the mouths came fire, smoke, and brimstone. Well, who knows? That's something that John was just looking at and thinking, now, what on earth is that? He's probably looking at things like helicopters, tanks, grenade launchers, missiles flying through the air, all sorts of strange things blowing up, and just trying to figure out what on earth. And so he did his best, and perhaps in the future we'll recognize these things. Verse 18, by these three plagues, the fire, smoke, and brimstone, sounds like nuclear or chemical weapons, by these three plagues a third of mankind was killed by the fire, smoke, and brimstone which come out of their mouths. For their powers in their mouth, in their tails, for their tails are like serpents having heads, and with them they do harm. And so one third, probably of, went to my marginal note here, one third of the men, that's what one translation says, one third of the men of fascist Europe. So that's the counterattack that attacks the Holy Roman Empire or modern day Babylon. So back to Isaiah chapter 13, and we're at verses 19. So Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And of course the angel said in Revelation 18 that with violence, with great violence, the city of Babylon will be thrown down. Verse 20, it will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabian pitch tents there, nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there, but wild beasts of the desert will lie there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there. Hyenas will howl in their citadels, and jackals in their pleasant palaces. Her time is near to come. Her days will not be prolonged. You can see that probably applies more to the first fulfillment, when these palaces, homes, lay empty and just, you know, animals taking refuge there, owls hooting and screeching and so on. But it can be encouraging, I suppose, to those who are not fortunate to be in a place of safety when they read the last verse, her time is near to come, her days will not be prolonged. Because I guess some of the folk that don't make it to a place of refuge, place of safety, will be increasingly familiar with some of these prophecies, and they'll say, well, you know, her time is near to come, won't be too long now, another year or two, three, whatever. And so that could be a mildly encouraging verse, although I think the best advice is, come out of her, my people, that you don't be partakers of her plagues. And none of us, in a sense, should be foolish enough to get cozy with today's world, its values, its standards, and be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Okay, into chapter 14, which is still the same prophecy, really. It's still dealing with Babylon. For the Lord will have mercy, or yet have mercy on Jacob. He will still choose Israel and settle them in their own land. The strangers will be joined with them, and they will cling to the house of Jacob. So although there's lots of trouble coming, Babylon will be dealt with, and then God, of course, will still have his people. You'll have to restore them, of course, rebuild them, give them teachers who will teach them the right way, and that should be the resurrected saints. But at that time, it says in verse 1 here, strangers will be joined with them, and these strangers will cling to the house of Jacob. People will want, actually, to be very close to Israel and the world tomorrow. It says, verse 2, then people will take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them for servants and maids in the land of the Lord. They will take them captive, whose captives they were, and rule over their oppressors. So in this yet future time, I think we see that probably being that the Israelites will be the leading nation, or nations perhaps, of the world tomorrow, and other nations will want to get close, share the benefits, find out the truth, and in many ways will become employees of Israel. Israel of the wealth, the knowledge, the blessings, and others will want to come close, sharing it. The older place then, look at Zechariah chapter 8, and the beginning of verse 1. Zechariah chapter 8, and verse 1. Zechariah comes after Haggai, if that helps. But Haggai's quite short, you miss it. Hard luck. Zechariah chapter 8 and verse 1. Talking of these yet future days when, for a change, people want to get close to Israel and Judah. Again, the word of the Eternal of Hosts came, saying, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, I am zealous for Zion with great zeal. With great fervor I am zealous of her. Thus says the Eternal, I will return to Zion and dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Jerusalem shall be called the City of Truth, the Mountain of Eternal Hosts, of the Holy Mountain. It's not that today, of course, but that will be how it's recognized and known in the world tomorrow. Thus says the Eternal Hosts, all men and all women shall again sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each one with his staff in his hand, because of great age. I'm not sure what great age means. I think there have been suggestions this could be hundreds of years old in the millennium, that lifespans will stretch to perhaps similar to what they used to be a long, long time ago. It doesn't say that clearly, but that's certainly been a suggestion. Maybe right. Here's people who are old and somewhat frail, so they've got a staff, I guess, to help them along, but could that be 200 or 300 or 500? Well, we can only speculate. The streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in its streets. Great time. Families living to see generation after generation after generation. Wonderful time. Verse 20. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, peoples shall yet come, inhabitants of many cities. The inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us continue to go and pray before the Eternal and seek the Eternal of Hosts. I myself will go also. Yes, many peoples, strong nations, shall come to seek the Lord of Hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Eternal. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, in those days, 10 men from every language of the nations shall grasp the sleeve of a Jewish man, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. You're blessed. You have God's favor. Can we come with you? Can we find out how it works? So whether these guys come from, Russia, China, the nations of the earth, now they're happy to join up with and associate with Israel and Judah can't really say that today, certainly for the Jews as a whole. I guess for the Israelites, if you're British or American, you know, some people are quite happy to come along. The Jews don't tend to get that sort of support, but in the world tomorrow, in the millennium, they will. So back to Isaiah chapter 14. So we're looking really here yet in the future. Verse 3, it shall come to pass in the day the Lord gives you rest from your sorrow and from your fear and the hard bondage in which you were made to serve. This is sometime after captivity, and obviously there was a fulfillment way, way back in the days of ancient Babylon, but I think from our perspective it's probably more relevant to think about it applicable today. It says, in the day that you have rest from your hard bondage of your captivity, that you will take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say. So the next number of verses are all, as it says, a proverb. Or in particular, some translation bring out, it's a taunting proverb. It's a mocking proverb. Because here's Israel. They've now been redeemed, set free. They're at peace. This may well be in the early stages of the millennium. And now they can look back at the leader of Babylon, the leader of the beast empire, and they can take up this mocking, taunting refrain or poem or proverb against this man. And, possibly, most would think probably, there's also an echo here of Satan. I think we often turn to Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, if we're looking at the history and the behavior of Satan the devil. Because ultimately you'd think, well, tell you what, if the king of Babylon is the leader of the beast empire, who would be motivating him? Who'd be driving him? Who'd be sort of giving him his thoughts and really leading him on? Well, Satan the devil. So when we read the next few verses, although directly it would relate to, as it says, the leader of Babylon, the king of Babylon, in our day perhaps the leader of the beast empire, you can see also this echo of Satan in there as well. So this is the proverb, starting at halfway through verse 4, how the oppressor has ceased, the golden city ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. He who struck the people in wrath with a continual stroke, he who ruled the nations in anger, is persecuted, and no one hinders. So this leader, this king of Babylon, as it's referred to here, is going to be punished, going to be brought down. His rulership ended. Verse 7, the whole earth is at rest and quiet. Now that's not today, but once this man and his empire are brought to nothing, or let's take it into another area, once Satan is dealt with, then the whole earth, the whole world, is at rest and quiet. And Godspeed those days. They break forth into singing. Indeed, the cypress trees rejoice over you, the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were cut down, you know, you king of Babylon, you leader, no woodsman has come up against us. And the trees probably symbolic of people just saying, since you've been dealt with, we have peace and quiet in the land. Verse 9, hell or Sheol in the Hebrew from beneath is excited about you to meet you at your coming. Now, this is not literal. I think we know that, you know, if you're dead, you're dead. Like a good old Rover, you're dead all over. You're not an immortal soul floating about somewhere. This is just a poetry from Isaiah. Hell from beneath is excited. This guy, don't forget, this leader has been the most proud, arrogant individual. He's number one in the world. He's conquered nations. You know, everybody's looked up to him. He's had the power. And now he's brought down low, and in fact brought down to death. Ignominious ending. So it says, hell, or the grave, from beneath is excited about you, to meet you at your coming. It stirs up the dead for you, all the chief ones of the earth. It has raised up from the thrones all the kings of the nations. This would be, in a sense, it's picturing as if the dead kings of the past would sort of stand up and, quote, welcome you. They shall all speak and say to you, Have you also become as weak as we? Have you become like us? Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, the grave, and the sound of your stringed instruments. The maggot is spread under you, and worms cover you. This was the great leader. This was the man, the beast leader, who conquered and ruled the world briefly, and now he's nothing. Verse 12, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you've said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. Now, so that point, verses 12 through, whatever it was, 14, 15, that we tend to jump and say, well, that's obviously talking of Satan. Well, that's certainly an interpretation that we are all comfortable with. It's talking directly, of course, about the leader, about the king. And this man is so arrogant and pompous and vain that he says, I can ascend into heaven, my throne can be above the stars of heaven, I will sit above the mount of the congregation, I'll be like the Most High. He's a man who puts himself in place of God. And yet, for all that, he's brought down to nothing and destroyed. But of course, we do also think we see here, you know, a sort of a reference to Satan the devil, because it does say in verse 12, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, I'll deal with that in a moment, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. So it's certainly the case that if this is a leading individual, the leader of the beast empire, that behind him, surely you'd find Satan the devil, the one who will give him the creativity and the spark and the energy and the mystical powers to deceive the world, no doubt about it. So this could well be giving us insight into Satan himself. But the catch here, in a sense, that we've dealt with, I think, once before, is the term Lucifer. How you're fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. Because I think, I've written an article on this a few years back, Lucifer is not right. Lucifer is not in the Hebrew Bible. Lucifer is a Latin term. Lucifer means light bringer. Used to get, I'm told, in bygone generations, you could buy matches called Lucifers, and you strike them and they light up. Because Lucifer is a Latin word, which means light bringer. And we often refer to the devil. Well, I try not to, but I think it's very common to refer to the devil as Lucifer, light bringer. Well, he isn't, and he wasn't. The term here in the Hebrew is, we'd write it as Halel, H-E-Y-L-E-L. Obviously, that's English letters, not Hebrew letters, but that's what we'd say, H-E-Y-L-E-L. So actually, it reads, if you leave that in, how are you fallen from heaven, Halel, son of the morning? So, okay, what's Halel? Is that a Hebrew word meaning lightbringer? Because that's what you might think. Well, the answer is no, no. Actually, nobody's too sure exactly which root word Halel comes from, but it's one of two choices. One is Halal, H-A-L-A-L, H-A-L-A-L, and that means mad, boasting, foolish. Mad, foolish, boasting, or boaster. Or Halel comes from another Hebrew word, and it's the only other choice you have, is Yalal, Y-A-L-A-L, Yalal. Sounds different in English, but the Hebrew apparently is very, very similar. And that means howl, or wail, or lament. Some sort of cry of wailing. So you got a choice. It's one of those two. Either mad, boast, foolish, or howling, wailing, lamenting. It is not any way, shape, or form to do with bringing of light. And so two possible translations would be, how are you fallen from heaven, O mad, boastful fool, son of the morning? Now, you could certainly apply that to the leader of the beast empire. Here's a guy who was boasting and proud and arrogant, and the whole world looked up to him, and it was on his own strength he'd done all these things. And so the words are, how you're fallen from your great height, you mad, boastful fool. Or the other translation would be, how are you fallen from heaven, O howler, son of the morning? Again, very similar, howler. In fact, the concordant version of the scriptures reads, how you have fallen from the heavens, howl, son of the dawn. You are hacked down to the earth, defeater of the nations. So the term Lucifer, as applied to Satan, is really, I think, a bit of misdirection. Certainly the devil would like to be known as an angel of light. I'm sure Satan would love to be referred to by people as a light bringer. He probably appeared to Eve in the Garden of Eden as one bringing light to the woman. Oh, as God said, you shouldn't eat of all those trees? Well, he knows if you eat that, then you'll be filled with insight and knowledge and wisdom. Please, try it. He's always pretended to be a light bringer, but he's not. He is, he's a mad, boastful fool. He's a howler. He'll be howling pretty soon when all these plans come to naught. So the term Lucifer really should not be applied to Satan. It's the only person you apply Lucifer to, strangely enough, is the one who brought light into the world. And that's Jesus Christ. I am the light of the world. Jesus brings light. He is the light bringer. And strangely enough, that's actually in the scriptures. If you turn to 2 Peter 1:19, you can't see it in the English. And I haven't found a translation yet that actually translates it properly, but 2 Peter 1:19, and here we read Peter writing to the brethren like you and me, says, we also have the prophetic word made more sure. Of course, the reading in the book of Isaiah, which is a prophetic word, it says, which you do well to heed. I guess we're doing our best to get a sort of basic understanding of the prophecies of Isaiah. Who knows how relevant it might become in a year or two. But he says anyway, we also have the prophetic word made more sure, which you do well to heed, as a light that shines in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. Okay, so we need to pay attention until the morning star. I think the King James might say day star, but anyway, the New King James says morning star rises in your hearts. Okay, what's the problem? Well, this is English. It translates from the Greek. Okay, in the Greek, there is no word for morning and no word for star. So you think, this is interesting. How can you sort of translate the Greek into morning star when the Greek doesn't have any word for either of those two? That's only one word in the Greek, and that word is phosphorus. You've been to school, you might know what phosphorus is. It tends to ignite quite easily. Phosphorus is the Greek word. Check it out online if you want. It says, until the day dawns and the phosphorus rises in your hearts. That's not knocking of a chemical, can explode in your insides. But guess what phosphorus means? Light bringer. And if you translate into Latin, that would be Lucifer, because Lucifer is a perfect translation of phosphorus. The word phosphorus comes from two words meaning light bearer or light bringer. So you could translate this, until the day dawns and Lucifer rises in your hearts. And of course you get uncomfortable, oh, the devil. But no, it's talking of the actual, genuine Lucifer, the light bringer, the light of the world. So, certainly Lucifer is not a good term to use for the devil, because he's not a light bringer, never has been. Okay, back to Isaiah, chapter, where I was 14, I think. So this particular section of verses 12, 13, 14 directly is on about this arrogant, mad, boastful fool, but we can see there an echo of perhaps the spirit being behind him. Verse 16, those who see you will gaze at you and consider you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world as a wilderness and destroyed its cities, who did not open the house of his prisoners? Because this is a man. This is, you know, the boss man, the head honcho of the Holy Roman Empire. And now he's brought down low. And of course, at a point in time, you know, Satan will be brought down low, not long after this. Verse 18, all the kings of the nations, all of them sleep in glory, everyone in his own house. I guess, you know, great big fancy tombs and so on. But you are cast out of your grave like an abominable branch, like the garment of those who are slain, thrust through the sword, who go down to the stones of the pit, like a corpse trodden underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land and slain your people. The brood of evildoers shall never be named. Now, his dynasty, if he had one, is stopped. You know, no more brood of him. Prepare slaughter for his children, because of the iniquity of their fathers, lest they rise up and possess the land and fill the face of the world with cities. Well, I guess, you know, his children could be, I guess, direct, you know, descendants, sons and so on, or I guess those who are his children in the sense of being his students, his disciples. But anyway, it comes to an end. He's no more. For I will rise up against them, says the Lord of hosts, and cut off Babylon, the name and remnant, and offspring and posterity, says the Lord. I will also make it a possession for the porcupine, marshes of muddy water. I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, says the Lord of hosts. Because it's going to brush it all away. You know, swampland. It's finished. It might be the leading nation of the earth for the next few years. And I read this morning that Germany currently is the most powerful economic nation in Europe. Europe apparently is moving rather rapidly out of recession, and right at the very front is Germany. It's absolutely dominating Europe at the moment in terms of its economy. It's running at, I think, four times the growth of other nations in Europe. In fact, if you took Germany out of Europe, it would be really quite a feeble empire. But Germany, massively powerful, although still got some way to go, I guess, before they can take over. Anyway, verse, where are we, 24? the Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, as surely as I have thought, so it shall come to pass. As I have purposed, so it shall stand. You know, God's plans will happen. Nothing is going to restrain them or divert them. That I will break the Assyrian in my land, and on my mountains tread him underfoot. So he switched, in a sense, from Babylon to Assyria, but actually they're pretty close. According to Wikipedia, it's a well-known place to find knowledge. It says in Wikipedia, Babylon and Assyria share essentially the same language, culture, religion, history, and ethnicity. So they're very, very similar. And in fact, the king of Assyria called himself the king of Babylon as well. So it's quite easy to swap from Babylon to Assyria, and if Babylon pictures the end time beast empire, well, Assyria or Germany likely to be its leader. So God says, verse 25, I will break the Assyrian in my land, and on my mountains tread him underfoot. Then his yoke shall be removed from them, and his burden removed from their shoulders. This is the purpose that is purposed against the whole earth. This is the hand that is stretched out over all the nations. For the Lord of hosts has purposed, and who will annul it? His hand is stretched out, who will turn it back? God's plans, the good news is, will come to pass. I guess perhaps in the end time some people might get a bit nervous that it's not going to happen, particularly if they're at the receiving end of modern day Babylon's troubles. But they will come to pass. They can read this and think, yeah, God's purpose, the end of Babylon, it's going to happen, and hopefully very soon. Moving on to verse 28, we swap now from Assyria and from Babylon to another portion of that area. This is the burden, which came in the year that King Ahaz died. Burden, again, being this weighty, heavy prophecy. Do not rejoice, all you of Philistia, because the rod that struck you is broken. So Philistia is now being spoken to. Who are the Philistines? Well, the Latin word for Philistia, I think it's in the King James, is Palestine. This appears to be addressed, therefore, to the Palestinians. And, of course, they are still broadly there today, still in the Middle East, still causing a lot of pain and grief to the nation of Judah over there, still fighting, still terrorist activities, still lots of problems. And so this is addressed really to the, the Palestinians, as we'd use that term. Do not rejoice, all you Palestinians, because the rod that struck you is broken. Meaning, don't be happy that Judah has been given a good beating up. Don't rejoice that the Jews are being taken off captive and their cities and towns destroyed by the German-led beast empire. Obviously, that could have a historic fulfillment in Isaiah's day, but one equally for our day. And you can understand, I think, looking at some of the pictures you see on TV occasionally, once the modern beast empire invades Judah and takes captive many, many Jews, what do you reckon the Palestinians will be doing? They'll be doing a dance, parties, breaking out all the goodies. And God says, don't. Do not rejoice, all you Palestinians, because the rod that struck you is broken. For the serpent's roots will come forth a viper, and its offspring will be a fiery flying serpent. So there's worse coming your way. Verse 30. The firstborn of the poor will feed, and the needy will lie down in safety. God will protect his. But for the Palestinians, he says, I will kill your roots with famine, and it will slay your remnant. Because once you kill the roots of something, that's it, over. If the roots are still there, things can regrow. But God says, I'm going to kill your roots with famine. Wail, O gate, cry, O city, all you of Philistia, all you Palestines are dissolved. For smoke, this will be armies, I think, picturing. For smoke or armies will come from the north, and no one will be alone in his appointed times, or no straggler in his ranks. A powerful nation heading down, you're not going to escape, you Palestinians. So no point in jumping around and dancing because the Jews are being taken care of. Actually in the same area, and you're going to be in trouble too. What will one then answer the messengers of the nations? Simply this, that the Lord has founded Zion, and the poor of his people shall take refuge in it. And that might be an implication that if the Palestinians want to keep shouting that, they deserve to own and occupy the land, tough, because the Lord, Jehovah, founded Zion, and his people will dwell in the land. End of story. No negotiation allowed. Okay, then, moving on to chapter 15. Now the burden against Moab. So we've had burdens against Babylon, and now we're moving our attention to Moab. Moab is what we believe to be modern-day Jordan. It's a country that borders modern-day Israel, and you can travel from one to another. And in the land of Jordan, one of its best-known tourist places is, of course, Petra, which might be cropping up a few verses from now. So here's the burden, or this weighty prophecy from God through Isaiah to the people of Jordan, the Jordanians. And it's talking of their destruction. In fact, really chapters 15 and 16 are really one long chapter. The way it's broken up in our Bibles is a bit arbitrary. But Isaiah 15 runs through into 16. And it says, verse 1, because in the night Ar of Moab is laid waste and destroyed, because in the night Kir of Moab is laid waste and destroyed. Okay, well, now verse 1, most translations don't say in the night, but rather in a night. Like the New American Standard Bible says, surely in a night, Ar of Moab is devastated and ruined. Well, Ar is the capital city of Moab. just like Damascus is of Syria and Jerusalem is of Jordan and so on, and implies that Jordan is destroyed in one single night. So, you know, could be quite a time of turmoil at the end of this age. You're talking about really turning the world upside down in just a very brief period of time. So potentially in a single night, Moab or Jordan is destroyed. And because of that, verse 2, he has gone up to the temple and Dibon to the high places to weep, you know, running off to their places of worship, beating their chests and so on. Moab will wail over Nebo and over Medeba. Nebo is a mountain to the east of Jordan. That's where Moses came to his end. He was taken up to top of Moab, or I guess he climbed up, thinking about it. And from up there, God showed him, you know, across Jordan into the promised land, but said, sorry, Moses, this is the end of your journey, mate, and that's as far as it's going to go. And so Moses was buried. I guess he's still there somewhere in that area. But anyway, Nebo is a high mountain to the east part of Jordan. Medeba is another town. And so here's the people of Jordan running around, but like headless chickens, because they're being destroyed. It says, carrying on all their heads will be baldness and every beard cut off. That's just a, you know, sign of being humbled or wailing and being distraught. In their streets, they will clothe themselves with sackcloth. On the tops of their houses and in the streets, everyone will wail, weeping bitterly. Heshbon and Elealeh will cry out. Well, to cities, their voice shall be heard as far as Jahaz. Therefore the armed soldiers, the army of Moab, will cry out, his life will be burdensome to him. Jordan might well rejoice for a while as Judah gets punished, but Jordan is going down as well, apparently in a night, in one night. Verse 5, my heart will cry out for Moab. My heart, talking of Isaiah, so Isaiah is, he's got compassion. He's not sort of jumping around at their destruction. He's actually quite sorrowful. Far better to get right with God and avoid all these problems and live a good life and a profitable life and end up as a king or a high priest forever and God's family going forward and all the rest of it. But instead of that, devastation, destruction, young and old. And Isaiah says, my heart will cry out for Moab. His fugitives shall flee to Zoar like a three-year-old heifer. I'm not quite sure what a three-year-old heifer flees like, but anyway, some of Isaiah's language is a bit colourful. But Zoar is way down south of the Dead Sea. That's where Lot fled to after he left Sodom and so on. So these folk are disappearing south. Not a surprise, because Europe is to the north, and if you've got German-led leading the beast empire, or even the threat of the Soviets and so on, well, you would probably turn tail and go south, young man. So it says, his fugitives will flee to Zoar like a three-year-old heifer, whatever that means, for by the ascent of Luhith they will go up with weeping. That's another mountain somewhere in that area, and you have to ascend and go up to it. For in the way of Horonaim they will raise up a cry of destruction. For the waters of Nimrim will be desolate. I mean, these names mean nothing to me, I've got to say. I suppose if you're an adventurer, a traveller, you could go around Jordan with an ancient map and probably track these places down. But anyway, for the waters of Nimrim will be desolate, for the green grass is withered away. The grass fails, there is nothing green. That's either weather conditions or more likely just the effect of weapons, the grass being destroyed, nothing to eat off the trees. Verse 7, therefore the abundance they have gained and what they have laid up they will carry away to the brook of the willows. So there'll be some things they can put in their backpacks and off they go, either in bicycles or mopeds or old cars and so on, heading south away from all the trouble to the brook of the willows, which appears to be somewhere in the region of Arabia. Again, you're heading south and maybe a bit east. For the cry has gone all around the borders of Moab, it's wailing to Eglaim and is wailing to Beer Elim. for the waters of Daimon will be full of blood. Well, I get that part, all right. There's so much death and destruction that the rivers and streams for the north will be just red-coloured with blood. Because I'll bring more upon Daimon, lions upon him who escapes from Moab and on the remnant of the land. Send, carrying on, because it's really one prophecy of this next part. It's curious and there's got lots of speculation attached to it. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah to the wilderness, to the mount of the daughter of Zion. For it shall be as a wandering bird from out of his nest, so shall be the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. Well, the fords of the Arnon is a river, and obviously, the river cuts, I think, east-west, so you have to cross over it if you're heading south. So if you're trying to escape from Moab, which is in your north, you head down south, you get to the river, and I guess if it's deep at that point, or there's been heavy rains, it might be tricky to get over it. And verse 2 suggests that the refugees from Moab are like, your headless chickens. It says wandering birds front of the nest, so I guess they're not quite mature yet. Maybe they're mature enough and the mama bird just gives them a good boot out of the nest. They've got to try and fend for themselves and they're fluttering and running around and so on. And that's what it's like. These folk have escaped from Moab or are escaping from Moab and they're running around, in a panic. Verse 3, take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow like the night in the middle of the day, hide the outcasts, do not betray him who escapes, let my outcast dwell with you, O Moab, be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler, for the extortioner is at an end, devastation ceases, the oppressors are consumed out of the land. Now, that particular part there leads to a couple of different interpretations as to exactly who's being asked to shelter whom, and which outcasts are being hidden by whom. It definitely says here, verse 3, take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow like the night in the middle of the day. That provides, sort of comfort to hide someone in the darkness. Hide the outcasts, it says. Don't betray him who escapes. So somebody's being told to hide those who are on the run. It says, hide the outcasts. Don't betray him who escapes. Let my outcasts dwell with you, O Moab. Be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler. Now, Dr. Herman Hay, many years ago in the early 60s, wrote an article on the place of safety. And he used these verses to say that this is Jordan, this is Moab, being instructed to hide God's outcasts. Verse 4, let my outcasts dwell with you, O Moab, be a shelter to them. And his belief there was that perhaps the Christians on the run from Judah, ahead of the beast empire, would make their way down here to, look at verse 1, send the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah. Well, Selah is a Hebrew for rock, and the Greek for rock is Petra. And in fact, the Amplified translation of verse 1 says, send lambs to the ruler of the land from Selah or Petra, through the desert and wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. So Mr. Hayes says, well, hang on a second. I take these verses to say that at this end time, God's people will be making their way as outcasts, refugees, down to Selah or Petra in Jordan, i.e. Moab. And the Moabites, or Jordanians, have been told to hide my people, keep them secure from the beast empire. So that was Mr. Hayes' view. And of course, it could be right. Although in the day Mr. Hay wrote, Petra in Jordan was a fairly unknown little place, whereas nowadays it's the number one tourist attraction in Jordan, and everybody knows about Petra. It's no longer a secret little place. In fact, some years back we used to associate on I think it was a Wednesday evening with some Seventh-day Adventists in our town of Worcester, And the guy who used to run a weekly sort of slideshow of places he'd been, and he'd been everywhere apparently, from what I could make out. You know, if it's there, he's been to it, and he's got the slideshow to prove it. He's got slideshows of the islands off the west coast of Scotland where Sabbath keepers existed in the 600s and 700s and 800s AD. He's got slideshows of Buddhist temples in places like Thailand and so on. He's got slideshows of parts of America in olden days where the Adventists first began. He's got slideshows of the Vatican. I've been to parts of the Vatican the Pope hasn't been to. And then one day I was speaking to him and I said, you ever been to Petra? Oh yeah, he says, I've got a slideshow, want to see it? Incredible, really. So next week he brought his slideshow of Petra. This guy, you know, has been everywhere, been to the moon probably by now, and the slideshow was pretty good. But you just think to yourself, you know, Petra is not a secret little place that only a few in the know have heard of. You know, people by the barrowload nowadays have been to Petra. There's not a place that is easy to overlook. And so, you know, whether or not Petra is the place of safety, I think one has one's doubts. Certainly, you know, one of the leaders of one of the Churches of God, if you can use that expression, says that Petra is going to be a place of slaughter, not a place of safety. And so the other way of looking at this is probably, in my view, a slightly more natural way of reading it, which is we're talking here about the ones who are milling around like headless chickens are the Moabite refugees, and they're seeking to be hidden and given protection, because that's what they're after. That's why they're leaving Moab. Verse 4, it says, "Let my outcast dwell with you, O Moab," but that translation is not one that is altogether common. The New American Standard Bible says, "Let the outcasts of Moab stay with you." So not saying to Moab, "Hide my outcasts." It's saying, "Let the outcasts of Moab stay with you, possibly, O daughter of Zion." The Amplified says, "Let our outcasts of Moab dwell among you. Be a sheltered hiding place to them from the destroyer." So it looks like maybe the refugees from Jordan are milling around this ford, and they're looking to someone else to protect them and safeguard them and to keep them from the destroyer. Now, who would that be they're looking to? Well, that potentially could be God's people, who will be able to provide perhaps some succor and some safety to these refugees from Jordan, because there's a possibility, and it's only speculation, that God's people will be maybe not too far from this area, but quite possibly not in Petra or Sela itself, because there's a suspicion that the place of safety may well be in modern-day Arabia, not too far away. Anyway, so moving on, verse 5. So talking about this time of great trouble, the Jordanians escaping as best they can, seeking, apparently, or at least one interpretation, seeking some hiding place, some refuge. Verse 5, "In mercy the throne will be established, and one will sit on it in truth, in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking justice and hastening righteousness." Well, what that tells you is it's an end-time prophecy. So it may well have had it will have had a fulfillment back in Isaiah's day, in the days of ancient Moab. But this is talking of Jesus Christ sitting on a throne in the tabernacle of David and judging righteously. So these events have got fulfillment in our day today, and it does suggest the Jordanians, some of, will be looking for help. Verse 6, "We have heard of the pride of Moab," Jordan. "He is very proud of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath, but his lies or vain talk shall not be so. Therefore Moab shall wail for Moab. Everyone shall wail. For the foundations of Kir Hareseth you shall mourn. Surely they are stricken." So no surprise if Jordanians will be deeply grieved with each other. "For the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sibma. The lords of the nations have broken down its choice plants, which have reached previously to Jazer and wandered through the wilderness. her branches are stretched out, they're gone over the sea. It implies at one point a very luxurious, prosperous nation, but now the lords of the nations, the attacking armies, have broken down through all of that. Verse 9, therefore, it looks like Isaiah again, I will bewail the vine of Sibmah with the weeping of Jazer. I will drench you with my tears. Isaiah is obviously, you know, quite moved by all of this that's going to happen. O Heshbon and Eliela, for battle cries have fallen over your summer fruits and your harvest. Gladness is taken away, and joy from the plentiful field. In the vineyards there will be no singing, nor will there be shouting. No treaders will tread out wine in their presses. I have made their shouting cease. Therefore my heart, again this is Isaiah, therefore my heart shall resound like a harp for Moab, and my inner being for Kir Hiris. So again, Isaiah is, he's not putting this on. Isaiah is a soft heart. He's carrying some pretty horrible messages to Judah, to Israel, to Assyria, to Babylon, but certainly for Moab, for Jordan, which is related at the end of the day to Israelites, then Isaiah is really quite hurting. At verse 12, and it shall come to pass, when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place, that he will come to his sanctuary to pray. Even then, it looks like they're going to God. They'll go to their own sanctuary, and the god of the Moabites was the Chemosh. That was the national god, I think it gets mentioned in the next chapter or two. But they'll go to Chemosh, and what's the point of that? You know, these gods can help you. There's only one god can help. You and I should know that. Only one place you and I need to be looking for safety. If we dwell into the secret place of the Most High, we be protected. And whether it's 1,000 on one side and 10,000 on the other. Verse 13, this is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning Moab since that time. But now the Lord has spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of a hard man, the glory of Moab will be despised with all that great multitude, and the remnant, those who are left, will be very small and feeble. And within 3 years of this particular date, that would happen, first time round. 3 years exactly, I think, is what's implied there. It talks of the years of a hired man. If you were an indentured man and were serving for 3 years, when that was up, you were off. Didn't sort of stretch it at all, wasn't elastic. And so here it's more or less saying, from this particular moment when Isaiah gave this first fulfillment, 3 years from now, on the dot, and Moab's had it. It'll be small and very feeble. And then obviously we won't continue on today, but chapter 17 brings us to, as it says there, the burden or the heavy weighted prophecy against Damascus. Damascus being the capital city of Syria, which at that time was allied with Israel and busy attacking Judah. But we'll read the what happened to Damascus and Syria next week. Okay, with that, brethren, I think we can conclude our Bible study for today.